As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to Soccer 101, the podcast where we answer the questions about the beautiful game you never knew you had. Today, we're talking about a piece of soccer apparel that has been around since the 1500s. No, it's not Graham Rutherford's shirt collection, but football boots, or soccer cleats, if you will. And in particular, we're looking at boot sponsorships. What is the story of the cleat? Who made them first? Who brought them to prominence? And who has made some bank by wearing them on the biggest stage? My name's Ryan Bailey, and we're kicking off with some studs who are going to be talking about studs, namely Taylor Rockwell. Hello.
Hello. I like that. I like the idea of Graham having a shirt from the 1500s. Graham, do you? What is the oldest jersey you have?
It's not from the 1500s, I can tell you that much, but probably 1600s? My, yeah. Yes, 1600s, yeah, let's play it conservative, yeah, 1600s, 1700s.
Jamestown FC over here in the US, I like that one.
Yep. Exactly, yeah. No, in actuality, it's probably a Cantona shirt from the early 90s.
There we go.
Graham Rutherford, welcome to the show. I was expecting you to say you had a shirt from, well, during the Battle of 1066, they had a little break and played soccer and they broke out some shirts, one of which you own. I'm disappointed you don't.
I mean, I would like one of those shirts. If any listener knows how I can get my hands on one of those, yes, I'll add that to my collection.
Joining us also, Joe Lowry. Hello, sir.
Hello, Ryan Bailey. Graham, I think you get that jersey by robbing a museum is the answer to that question.
Or being part of the battle.
That I works too.
Yeah, the latter sounds easier, actually.
You realize you're strategizing getting a jersey I made up, by the way.
I mean, I have concept jerseys for NASA. So pretty much the same idea.
That's a great, they should do like throwback jerseys for like, yeah, the Battle of Hastings, the Battle of Stirling Bridge, that could get one. I feel like Graham would go for that one rather than the Battle of Hastings.
Yeah, a bit too southerly for Graham's taste, I'd imagine. Quite right there, Tay-Tay. Before we get started into boots and boot sponsorship, I'd like to go around the horn. I'd like to know your favorite pair of soccer cleats that you've ever owned. I'll go first to get the ball rolling. I was one of those kids who everyone I played with had like the Adidas Predators or the Puma Kings. I always had like sort of second tier like Mizuno and some Lottos back in the day. But I think my favorite pair are the pair I have now. They're a Nike pair. I don't even know what they're called. They were $25 from Dick's. They are falling apart. I've had them probably 9 years and they're just way, way more comfortable than anything else I've ever worn. I bought pairs since then that they just blister me up. And I go back to these ones, which are very much on their last legs. So I'm probably not doing Nike a great service there. They're like, you remember Jack Grealish when Aston Villa got promoted to the Premier League and he had those boots on where they were literally falling apart. Oh, yeah. They were like his lucky boots. Those are what mine look like at the moment. Graham, how about you?
So I was really into boots when I was young. So I had a few. I had a pair of Predators that the tongue kind of they kind of bandied round the bottom, the sole of the shoe, so you would cover your laces, the idea being that you'd have a cleaner connection. Of course, made no difference to how I played soccer at that level, but I like to think that it did. And then I also had a pair of, and to me now this sounds terrible, and I would never have picked these now because I would probably just go for a black pair of Copa Mundiales, but I had an all-white pair of Reeboks that Ryan Giggs wore at the time, and they were so unbelievably comfortable, and I genuinely felt like I played better in them. And then I lent them to a friend once for a game that I wasn't playing in, and he never gave them back to me because he said he played better in them as well. So I never saw them again, and they were about probably about £80. So I wasn't best pleased.
I think you mean ex-friend, not friend.
Yeah,
ex-friend.
Exactly. Yeah,
there's some symmetry in Ryan Giggs' boots and something being taken that doesn't belong to some. Anyway, I don't know where I was going with that thought. Graham, what you should point out perhaps to the American listeners is the consequence of when perhaps we were younger, if you wore any cleat that wasn't black, if you wore white or purple or pink, what would happen if you turned up like to a game in those boots?
You would get halved.
Yes, you would get immediately targeted. This guy fancies himself. Let's take him out. That is,
you were a target. You were the Grealish in that team if you turned up in colourful boots. But it didn't stop a load of my teammates when I was a teenager actually buying those boots, including myself. As I say, I had an all white pair of Reeboks that I would just never wear now, but they were very comfortable.
Indeed. Taylor, how about you? Your favorite pair of cleats, and did you ever have any fancy colors that got you some attention?
I did later in life, because the club I played for, you had to have either all black or predominantly black boots for basically until I was 18. That's what I wore. So with that, I always my favorite one I ever got to wear with a little bit of color was the Predator Accelerator. Those things were legendary, and I remember, like, you know, pre-internet sort of, the whole idea of, like, it does something with swerve, and it makes it, like, you'll never hit the ball the same way. And I just remember being like, science will bend this ball into, like, a corkscrew and make me score a million goals. It didn't, but it made me feel like I was David Beckham or Zinedine Zidane, and that was fun. Later on, I tend to wear all black still. So there was a pair of Adidas Adi Zeros that were all black that I loved and will forever try to find, but the modern ones are all a bit fancier and flashier. I've never really worn brightly colored boots. White, I think, is the biggest outlier for me. It's either white or black normally.
Yeah, my current pair were white. They are no longer white.
That's the downside, yeah.
Exactly. Joe, how about you?
So I am very similar to you, Ryan, in that my $25 to $35 pair of cleats from Dick's are usually what get me through. There was a time, though, where I was roped into playing a game of pickup soccer with a college coaching staff, and I have no idea why they roped me in, because I am not good. But I didn't have any cleats or boots with me at the time, and so I actually borrowed a pair of one of the assistant coaches, and I don't know what they were, and I'll never have access to them again, but I liked those very, very much, and I've been on the hunt to find those mystery suckers ever since.
Wow. One more cleat story I'll give you, by the way. At the 2014 World Cup, I was in Brazil, and there were Yahoo Sports, and we shot a segment where I would go and play pickup with some local Brazilian kids who were just phenomenal, and you really got an insight into how different the way they play soccer is to the European way. But I was there with Adidas, and they gave me a pair of cleats to wear to this pickup game. They gave me, I don't know if you remember them, but Leo Messi had these really fancy cleats at that tournament that were like black and white, almost like Dalmatian, but like rectangles. And they cost $300. And right. I put them on for this game, and I thought, these are the least comfortable boots I've ever worn. I did not like them at all. And I ended up giving them to one of the kids who was like, oh my God, this is the most incredible thing ever. I was like, yeah, okay. Thank you. You're very welcome. You're very welcome. But I think it goes to show that price doesn't always dictate how great a cleat is, but it also goes to show something we're going to be talking about in this episode, that the commercial realities of cleats and how, you know, they are very, very big business. Leo Messi obviously being a proponent of having a big sponsorship for his cleat with Adidas. Taylor, why don't we go a little bit further back in history from Leo Messi? I'd love to hear a little bit of history, the timeline of cleats, because looking at my research, apparently in Henry VIII times, Tudor times, we're going back in English history again, they had the first sort of cleats all the way back then.
And from my understanding, that's basically the design until about 1940 that they stuck with. The kind of high ankle boot, heavy leather. They added some metal studs to those, but they were fixed in place. And I think the idea up until the 40s was that you're protecting yourself. It's not about being agile or quick or being able to get to the ball first. Certainly not about getting the corkscrew swerve on the ball. It's about protecting yourself from industrial challenges, agricultural challenges, I think is how we phrase it. And so you have very heavy, not particularly mobile boots, and that lasts, as I said, until around like the 1940s. There's some deviation there, but it's after World War II that you get a lot more versatility, but even then it takes until about the 70s and the 80s for things to really become modern. But it's in the 1920s that the Dassler brothers start sort of changing the design a bit. And then the kind of standout moment, as I understand it, happens in post-war Europe in 1953. There's a friendly between England and Hungary. England's still this sort of like the team to beat, even if they were a little bit weak, a little bit behind the times maybe. And this ended up being a fairly heavy loss for England. Hungary beat them 6-3 at home in England. This is an excerpt from The Ball Is Round. To a man, the England players look like they have just rolled up their sleeves for another hard shift at the factory. Their kit is baggy. The Hungarians is fitted. On their feet are heavy, high-cut leather clodhoppers. The Hungarians wear lighter, low-cut, modern boots. The Hungarians go on to win that game 6-3, as I said. In 1954, 1 year later, West Germany defeats that same Hungary team, and they're wearing innovative screw-in studs, courtesy of Adidas, who were sponsoring the team, and that allowed them to play through adverse conditions. There's not a huge amount of change in the ensuing decades. In the 1970s is when you start to get different colored boots. The first pair of white boots worn by Alan Ball for Everton and the Community Shield in 1970. That's where sponsorship starts to take hold, and we can talk a little bit about that, obviously. But then in the 80s, you get the kind of shift towards the more modern era that we have now, where there's still a lot of leather, but you're getting some synthetics, you're getting different colors, you're getting different textures, especially with the Predator coming onto the market in the 90s. That's where you get a ton of experimentation with the outer texture and with different synthetic fibers to allow you to do different things with the ball, and we continue to have that experimentation to this day.
Taylor. And the thing about those, sorry to jump in, Ryan, but the thing about those white boots you mentioned, Taylor, the ones that Alan Ball wore in 1970, do you know the story behind them, that they were never actually intended to be white? So he signs a sponsorship deal with Hummel, the Danish company, but Hummel didn't have any boots that fit him. So they took his old Adidas boots, his previous sponsor, they took his old black Adidas boots and thought, well, we need to make them different somehow so that they don't just look like Adidas boots. So they just painted them white and said that they were Hummel. And that's how you had the first pair of all white boots. I'm not sure you would get away with that now.
No, but I remember, that's funny, because that does lead to, like, I remember people when I was growing up where you had less variety would color in the stripes on Adidas to different colors to make them seem like they were custom. And you would get, like, some people painting them or applying different pens to make them seem like they were fancier than they might have been. So I like that that was even the manufacturer's approach early on.
Taylor, thank you very much for that timeline of evolution of cleats there, by the way. If you can cover 500 years of history in 2 minutes, why do Marvel films all need to be 3 hours long? That's all I can say.
You got to expand that universe, baby.
Indeed. Anyway, you mentioned there the Dassler brothers. Can we jump back to there and sort of the first suppliers, the first people who sort of mass marketed cleats, if you will? And typically the Dassler brothers, Adi Dassler, Adolf Dassler, back when it was still cool to be called Adolf in the 1920s, he started Adi Dassler, and his brother also started Puma, is that correct?
That is. There's a Soccer 101 episode way back in the feed where you can find the history of those two brothers, because yes, they start, I think they're initially working for the same company. Rudolph Leaves starts Puma, as you said. They do not like each other at all. There are debates about, I think there's like an affair alleged, but then even now there are debates about which one of them was a more hardcore Nazi, which is an interesting one since they both joined the Nazi party. And as I understand it, because still are, but definitely were headquartered in the same town, it was even this sort of like East-West Bloods Crips rivalry where like you can't intermarry. There's bars for Adidas employees. There are bars for Puma employees. We don't like each other. And that existed for a very long time until I think the brothers had less involvement in the companies and they became the kind of commercial juggernauts that they are today. I'm guessing they still don't like each other that much, but you did have that sort of sibling rivalry lead to a massive, massive rivalry between two huge companies.
So just to be clear, though, Taylor, Adi Dassler, Adi Dass. His name wasn't Adi, so it's not Adidas. Adi Dass. We good?
It's all day I dream about soccer. Thank you very much.
We do indeed.
You truly are a PR man to the core, Ryan Bailey.
I'm a stickler for the pronunciation of the acronym Adidas, as we have discovered there, Graham. Why don't we take a very quick break? When we come back, I want to get more into sort of this early stages of the commercial era of soccer cleats and when they sort of started to evolve, when players started to get sponsorships. More on that very shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Soccer 101, welcome back. We are talking about cleat sponsorship and the history thereof. Graham Ruthven, let's get into sort of the early days. We covered the Dassler brothers when sort of things were evolving in the early 20th century. Where did things go from there?
So from there, you kind of enter an age of commerciality, where in the 60s and 70s, you start to get more colourful boots. You start to get some player endorsements for the first time. One of the first big boot sponsorship deals was the one that George Best signed in the 1960s. And I think there were other boot deals before then with players, but this was a real landmark one. Best was one of the best players in the world at that time. And he signed a deal with a brand called Stylo at the time. They were going head-to-head with the German giants, and they sold 1 million of the Stylo matchmakers that Best wore at that point. And then from there, you have Pele reportedly being paid $125,000 to wear Puma boots at the 1970 World Cup. Of course, he had a longer association with that brand that I think is still going to this day. And then famously in the 1970 World Cup final, you have the incident of him bending down to tie his shoelaces very deliberately as the camera is on him. And obviously the camera pauses as he's tying his football boots, and the whole world sees his Puma Kings, and it all feels very deliberate and a ploy for that brand to get beamed around the world. And yeah, as I say, from there, you kind of have an age of commerciality that it leads right up to this day with boot deals. And I think the 1990s feels like when the football boot wars reached a whole new level. And I remember a lot of that because that was very much my decade. And that was when I was a kid, and that was when I was buying boots and really into boots. But I think by all accounts, once you get to the 90s, it is open warfare between a lot of the big brands and a lot of the players that wear the boots.
It's wonderful to think we went from Pele bending over to tie his shoelaces to Nicholas Bentner wearing Paddy Power pants. What an evolution.
The Pele tying his shoe is probably my favorite moment of boot sponsorship, but obviously because it's a crafted thing to stop play, the camera zoom in, it's the first like World Cup broadcast in color, so you can see that he's wearing Pumas, but also the idea that there was a sort of like armistice agreement between Puma and Adidas not to pursue him. Like, we're both going to leave him alone. We're not going to get into a bidding war. And they definitely agreed on that. And then Puma quietly said, we'll give you a ton of money to publicly sport our boots and humiliate our rivals. Again, Puma, Adidas, not liking each other. And so the kind of backstabbing aspect of that went into boot sponsorship, I guess, really kind of lays the groundwork for what's to come when it comes to how ruthless sponsorship can be.
Why don't you dig into that a bit, Taylor, sort of the sponsorship and how things went with teams, with Adidas and the World Cup?
Yeah, I think to echo what Graham said, I think
it does sort of... I just said Adidas instead of Adidas. I just put my own point.
We've won. We've won, America.
Yes, you're truly an American now, Ryan. Drink your soy latte. So I think it is a lot of individual sponsorship, like Graham talked about. You have Best in 1970, Pele as well. You have Maradona wearing Puma Kings in 1986. Puma really locking down some of the best players in the world. Good job by them. But as we move towards the 90s, that is where I think it becomes less about like the hugest names in the world. That said, in 1983, we have our first women's player sponsored, obviously Mia Hamm by Nike, and that indicates the rise of Nike onto the scene. But it really does become everybody is going to be sponsored. Everybody is going to have some sort of a boot deal. And that's even where we move from, okay, well, if everybody has boot deals, then certain players are going to get custom boots that will then be sold in the mainstream. So they are built for that player's foot. And that is cool because you can wear the same boots as Ronaldinho or Ronaldo. But you, I'm guessing, listener, do not have the same foot as Ronaldinho or Ronaldo. And if you ever look at the underside of that kind of... fair. Maybe you do. But if you look at the the underside of a boot, especially modern boots, and you see where the plastic molding is or whatever the material might be, that is the entirety of the support you're going to be getting. My friend who managed a soccer shop taught me this lesson. And the arch on that one, that it is built for an incredibly narrow foot almost always with not a lot of support. And most people are not world-class athletes who have 0 ounces of fat on them. So they don't really necessarily give you the support or the comfort that you might want, but they do work very well for the players for whom they are custom designed and built to perfectly fit their foot.
Very interesting. Thank you, Tay-Tay.
Yes, sir.
Joe, I think this maybe coincides with when I started getting interested in soccer cleats as well, but it seems to me that sponsorship and boot sponsorship became a bit more mainstream, a bit more serious in the 1990s. That's when, to my knowledge, you had really expensive commercials on TV. You had the Nike famous commercial started coming up.
Yeah.
You had Brian Giggs and Reebok then spending millions trying to sell his cleats to people. You had Ronaldo at France 98 having a very famous incident with Nike sponsorship and him wearing their brand and such, Joe.
Well, I think that era, it's not a coincidence that sponsorship sort of rises then because it's more visible, right? That's starting the rise of mass media where we can consume these things and these advertisements in so many different ways and at so many more times. There's so many more opportunities to be consuming those things than in the previous decades. So you have the 90s, you really are starting to get some of these brand wars. And then even thinking into the 21st century and into today, you have a very clear few dominant global providers. You have Adidas, you have Nike, you have Puma. There's others as well, but those are three of the biggest names in soccer boots or soccer cleats. And those are companies that have been very selective and very deliberate in who they're trying to target. Nike is an interesting one right now, especially. Adam Crafton had a good article for The Athletic out, I think, during a little closer to the heart of the pandemic, about Nike actually choosing to step back from such a wide range of athletes that they had targeted to compete with brands like Adidas and Puma. They'd step back a little bit, and players like Thiago and Rafael Varane and Sergio Ramos and Raheem Sterling and Robert Lewandowski, they were ending their relationships with Nike or vice versa, depending on the specific situation. And there are a couple different reasons given for that. One reason could be the COVID-19 pandemic putting a financial strain on companies, even in this still very active sponsorship brand war era. That's one reason. And the other reason is just Nike wanting to focus on a smaller number of athletes. And I don't know which of those is true. I'm guessing there's some truth to both of those explanations. But it's an interesting one to me because you're seeing players like Neymar leave Nike back in 2020. And that might be more for actually trying to make himself stand out relative to other Nike athletes. But you still have this change where you almost end up with a couple of key headlining players for each brand. So Nike now has Ronaldo, and they have had him for quite some time, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Kylian Mbappe. And those are sort of their two headliners. Puma has Neymar, who makes so much money from his sponsorship deal with Puma. He makes about $31 million a year, reportedly, from Puma. And then Adidas has Messi locked up, and he makes the second most money of any athlete in soccer in terms of sponsorship deals. So starting in the 90s, Ryan, as you sort of pinpointed, you had this flurry of interest and all of a sudden this realization that we need to go out as a brand and sign player X and player Y so that this brand doesn't get them. And now we are seeing maybe slightly clearer and more delineated brands and differences between their approaches to sponsoring athletes. But I do think a lot of that stemmed from the 90s.
I specifically remember the 98 World Cup in particular being an absolute battleground for brands and for boots, because you had Nike coming on to the scene for really the first time. It's easy to forget that Nike were not this big player in soccer for a long time. It was really about the mid to late 90s that they started to chase those deals. For a good example of this is Brazil for the 1994 World Cup. When they won that World Cup, they're wearing Umbro, a pretty traditional English brand that's been around for decades. By 1998, they're wearing Nike, and Ronaldo's wearing Nike boots. And so you had this giant brand with a lot of money. Keep in mind, you know, they were Air Jordan, Michael Jordan, basketball, all the American sports. They had a lot of backing, and they're entering the most popular, biggest sport in the world. So that 98 World Cup will always stick in my mind as not just a soccer tournament, but a battleground for those brands. And it's been interesting over the years since then how Adidas and Nike, and I read that same article, Joe, because I am a nerd and I'm interested in boot deals. And I remember reading it at the time and finding it really interesting. And it was interesting because up until then, Adidas and Nike had become these two massive camps where the best players were just getting divided into the two. And you had a lot of the smaller providers. So Umbro is a good example. You know, Umbro had Manchester United kits until when did they disappear, like the early 2000s or something like that. You had brands like Hummel, who I mentioned previously, and French brands like Lecoq Sportif, and in Italy you had Lotto and Kappa, and more recently Macron, although they don't really make boots. But everyone was just going into these two camps, the two biggest brands. And Puma, kind of, despite the fact that they had the history, and Puma more recently have come back with Neymar, as you mentioned, Joe, and Manchester City have Puma kits now, but for a solid 10 years Puma were regressing and contracting and getting smaller, and it was just all about Adidas and Nike. And I think we're slightly coming out of that now with some new brands. The two most prominent new brands are the two Americans and Under Armour and New Balance, who seem to be collecting some players. An interesting one is Trent Alexander-Arnold, obviously Liverpool right back, who is contracted to wear Under Armour boots, but obviously wore New Balance kits for a long time. So he kind of found himself in the middle of that battle. But New Balance have Raheem Sterling. They got him last summer in a deal worth tens of millions of dollars. They have Sadio Mane. They have Bukayo Saka. So they've got some big names as well. And it is interesting to see when a new brand comes on the scene, the players that they go to. So obviously New Balance have done some sort of analysis that Raheem Sterling is, you know, like an English icon and someone that can really sell boots. I find that whole thing fascinating.
Well, and a big part of that, I think, Graham, is, and we see this in the NBA, even with Steph Curry's story of going and having a meeting with Nike and then going to Under Armour because they couldn't get his name right. I think you see, because there are so many athletes being sponsored, players want the attention and the ability to have more of a personal relationship. I don't want to say they want attention like it's a bad thing, but they want to have the ability to relate and actually understand and work with and come alongside of a brand. And at a certain point, if you're just splitting between Adidas and Nike, and those companies both have hundreds of athletes on their books, you're not really going to get any sort of personalized attention. And so you see Steph Curry go and be an Under Armour athlete, and you see Trent Alexander-Arnold go and be a New Balance athlete. You see Neymar go and be, an Under Armour athlete. And then you go and see Neymar go to Puma and make bank while also being the guy for Puma. I think that trend is very real, and it's even a cross-sport trend as well.
Another thing that I found really interesting when I was doing the research for this, and I hadn't totally considered this, but of course it's an aspect of these brands, their analysis that they do, is almost the scouting that they have to do on what players are going to be the next big thing. And sometimes they get it right, and sometimes they get it wrong. I mean, I found a list of the highest paid players in terms of their boot deals, and it was from last year, so this may have changed, but number five on that list was Mario Balotelli from Puma, who gets £5 million a year from Puma, and that deal dates back to 2014 when he was just ending his deal with Nike. At that time, Puma thought, well, this guy's going to be around for the next few years as one of the biggest stars in the world, and that hasn't paid off for them. He's playing in Turkey for Adana Demirspor. I'm afraid I haven't even heard of that club, but that kind of tells you how he has kind of fallen from that level. And sometimes brands can get it right where they pick someone up as an 18-year-old and they have a relationship for years to come. But as Balotelli kind of proves there, sometimes you can get it wrong.
I cannot believe he hasn't retired. I 100% thought Mario Balotelli was retired. That's interesting to know. Graham, who are there any other like ridiculous names on that list? I got so excited to hear it because I really want there to be, like, I could see a man you and I have mentioned previously, like Adnan Januzaj, getting a deal, and then maybe that one didn't quite work out. I wonder who the other big names would be that didn't quite pan out.
Not really. I mean, he is the only outstanding name that you would never guess in the top 10. So the top 10 that I found was Neymar number one, Messi number two, Ronaldo three, then Mbappe, then Balotelli, then Gareth Bale, which I guess more recently he's probably not the sixth best player in the world, but at the time, I guess, Antoine Griezmann, Paul Pogba, Marco Verratti, Mohamed Salah. So these companies are pretty good at kind of judging who to go with, but as I say, sometimes they do get it wrong.
And they have, I think, not yet gotten it wrong when it comes to the lifetime aspect of things. Joe, you were talking about that one, and I think all three now have basically lifetime deals. Neymar has one with Puma, Messi with Adidas, Ronaldo with Nike. My question for you all, do you think that is actually like legitimately lifetime, or do you think that is their playing career? Because if we're still getting Maradona-inspired boots and Pele-inspired boots, it stands to reason that we'll be getting Messi Adidas boots 20 years from now, and I wonder if he will be getting £18 million per year every year that he's alive, because that seems like a pretty solid deal for him.
I want the Messi walkers. That's what I want. I want like for the upper, for the 65 plus pickup soccer. Yeah. That's the boot I want. I don't know the answer to your question, Taylor, but I think that should be a thing.
The Messi Crocs for when he retires. Yeah,
That's what I was envisaging, was Messi just wanting to wear like a pair of slippers and an Adidas rep just poking his head around the corner being like, no, predators at all times.
It really makes the comfort more tactile when you're wearing Predator slippers, yeah.
Taylor, I'd imagine those lifetime deals pertain to image rights, and they pertain to, money, and money coming from other places. So that is an interesting point. I'm still dazzled that Balotelli's getting 5 milli to go play in Turkey just to wear their cleats. That's incredible, Graham. That's a good find. Wow. Okay. Let's take a very quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about boot sponsorship and some of the biggest deals in boot sponsorship that have caught our eye. Back shortly. Soccer 101, welcome back. Graham Ruthven, I'm going to ask you a sincere question, which might sound curmudgeonly, but we've been talking a lot about the deals that players have and Neymar switching to Puma and all these kind of things. Should I care? I mean, sincerely, I mean, like, does it have an effect on, I suppose generally it's marketing, isn't it, at the end of the day, and it's going to have an effect on who buys which cleat, but does it have an actual impact sporting-wise?
Sporting-wise, no, I guess not. But should you care, the brands are making the bet that there will be enough people who do care that a player is wearing a certain type of boots. I would suggest that both you and I are now of a certain age where that is not the biggest thing in our life. But there was a point where every birthday and Christmas, I would ask for a certain pair of boots. And that would largely be dependent on who was wearing those boots at the time, whether it was Beckham or, as I say, Ryan Giggs or someone like that. So I guess there is some analysis being done in the background that enough people do care, but we are probably not that target market now.
That's completely fair. Taylor, if we look at the landscape of boot sponsorship at the moment, and we've mentioned some new players like your New Balances coming in to the fray, how do you see the landscape shaping up in the next few years? Are we going to get some new players in there potentially? Are Tesla going to make a boot at some point?
You never know. That would be a very Elon Musk thing. Trust me, no one has ever made football boots that are successful. I will do it. I'll put microchips and interfaces that then shut down when you're using them. I don't think that will work so well. I do think there will be maybe a little bit of change. I think we're still going to get the major powers because they have a ton of money and they have the money to sponsor those big name athletes. And so they will be front and center for forever. But I think, as with a lot of things, when brands get too big, they stop being maybe as responsive as they need to be, and they're not quite tailoring it to different clientele. And as I said, like, you're getting shoes that are more narrow. They're not necessarily made for wider feet. If you're buying one for wider feet, there seems to be an assumption that, like, you're okay with being slow. So then they're making them heavier. That's when you get, like, the real leather, like the Copa Mundials, I think, are the ones that will still be heavier but do fit a wider foot. And I do wonder if we're going to get newer companies or just smaller manufacturers, more localized manufacturers, creating like maybe more expensive shoes but nicer shoes for a greater variety of people. And that's where you've got companies, I will butcher this one, but Pantofola d'Oro, I think they're an Italian company that started making boots in 1886. They are very expensive, but everything they make is beautiful. It's all leather, the designs are amazing, they're just very innovative looking. And I think you'll get companies that do a smaller business, but are okay with doing a little bit smaller to make a higher end product. And that would be maybe a thing we will see, is less like mass manufactured boots, or at least a few less manufactured and more regional or local or just very specific. And I think maybe more national brands will continue to kind of do what they do. So maybe that's, I don't know if Kelme is still around. I haven't worn Kelme or seen Kelme very much, and Joma as well. But like Hummel will always be around, Hummel in Denmark. And I would expect that we'll get them doing different things to try to compete with the giant manufacturers, but in a different way. They're never going to be as global as Nike. So maybe you do a few more unique things, unique customizations to stay afloat in the market.
Sterling Albion or Joma from next season. I'm very much looking forward to that. In terms of what the big brands are going to do in the next few years, they change their minds all the time. And I think that's going to continue as long as there is soccer. You know, I mentioned Nike withdrawing from some markets and then all of a sudden they're back and they're trying to get players. I think Erling Haaland is going to Nike. Or actually, that might be Adidas. But this is a couple of years after Adidas saying they were also going to stop giving out new boot deals to big name players. Now they're getting Erling Haaland. Umbro pulled out of the market entirely and now they're back with some deals. So it's very fluid in terms of just the strategy of these companies. I guess a new person comes into Nike and all of a sudden they've got a new strategy and new ideas. And I think they're just all going to continue to jostle for position for decades to come.
And some of that, to my understanding, is deliberate tactics because ultimately, like, you're wearing a boot if it's got studs, if it's got laces, or I guess some boots don't have laces. Lotto, I think, the first one to do that. But I think you don't really need this much innovation, as I understand it. The Copa Mundials are pretty much a perfect shoe. They're a little bit heavier than maybe some other lighter weight models. But if you are just making one shoe over and over and over again, you're going to lose a lot of market share. So you've got to keep trying to appeal to different markets with different colors and different sizes and styles, but you're not always necessarily making it unique. I think you're just trying to cover a ton of bases. So then you'll get like removing yourself from a market or Adidas or Umbro dropping out for a minute to maybe create that demand of like, oh, remember Umbro? They were a great company. Let's bring them back. I could buy an Umbro. And then they do come back and then you do buy them. And I think that's what we'll continue to see is sort of that fluctuation because ultimately we're talking about shoes. And so it's you can add new technology, you can add new textures or new synthetic fibers or fabrics, but it's not that huge of a difference as I understand it. But the more you can market it as being a massive difference and maybe create that scarcity, the more money you're going to be able to make.
Marketeers, uncover your ears. Taylor has stopped speaking now. Thank you very much. It just made me think for some reason about Warrior Sports and the do you remember the cleats they made which had like two holes on the back? They're terrible colours and they had two holes on the back like by your Achilles, like the bit where you need a bit of protection, I would suggest. And they had like massive holes there. And I hope they don't come back, for example.
Yeah, I did find myself wondering if like we could if there would be somebody who was like they figured this out in the 1800s. We should go back to full high ankle boots. And they've sort of done that with the built-in sock that covers your ankle, but it's not quite as rigid. I guess you do have to be able to kind of move your ankle in the modern game a bit more than maybe giant leather boots would allow for.
Does anyone remember the Serafino 4th Edge from a few years ago, which were designed for players who wanted to toe poke the ball more often? They had the big flat edge on the front of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were bizarre.
Didn't Harry Redknapp like put money behind them, or he was at least endorsing them as he endorses absolutely everything?
That does not surprise me at all. That
what
if
are
you
these
put
shoes?
Money behind,
yeah, they're
just
incredible.
I'll just put an image of them in the Slack.
They're so ridiculous. Yeah. That's so nonsense.
Look them up, listener. Oh, big flat goodness. Edge on the front, almost if you were like using them on a work site or something. They're quite incredible. So I hope they don't come back, Graham. I hope the Warrior Sports boots don't come back. But if we're going to talk about sort of noteworthy boots and the deals and the creations, the one that I come back to is the Adidas Predator. And maybe this ties back to when I asked Graham, like, should I care about boots? Well, in terms of Adidas Predator, I suggest they were kind of a game changer in terms of what they did and their design and the way they allowed you to hit the ball differently. And actually, Taylor, perhaps you can talk about this. They were actually invented by a Liverpool player. This story is the modern equivalent of like Jordan Henderson inventing a brand new boot.
Yeah, you can see him in the Anfield rap if you want to. His bit is him, I think, sitting in the mud looking forlorn because his line was about how he doesn't get to play very much. But he ends up having a bit of influence when it comes to shoe design, though I don't think he ends up making the money that you would expect from it. But to my understanding, he's playing around with boots. He's kind of feeling like they don't give him enough control of the ball. There's not enough grip to give him the control he wants. And what Craig Johnson goes for, the Liverpool player, is a table tennis pad. And I think he takes the padding off of a table tennis racket, I guess. Is that what we call that? Paddle? And puts it onto a boot. He glues it on himself, I think. And then from there, that's the prototype. But I think he continues to develop it and utilize it. And he does indeed get different control or better control. But he also is able to put more spin on the ball and hit it in different ways with more force because you have these synthetic panels that like basically don't give as much cushioning. So they're going to hit it with more force. They're going to carry the ball forward. That's me explaining physics. Don't listen to me. But the idea is that they give you more power, more control. And I think Adidas from there take that idea and make them glorious. They are some of the most like innovative shoes that I will remember, even if they're probably 14 pounds in weight based on the look of the original Predators.
Yeah.
I was also really into table tennis bats, by the way. That's a completely true story. I loved a Stiga bat.
Really?
Yeah.
So what, you call them bats?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Stiga was the brand. They always made the best handles. It was always like cool wood. It was, yeah.
Cool right. wood. Cool wood, everybody. I do remember the Predators, they were very heavily marketed. It was Paul Gascoigne in the 90s, and it was David Beckham who wore them afterwards, and they were very coveted on the playing field. And some of my friends had them, and I didn't, because they were like over 100 pounds, which is outrageous, particularly in the 1990s. Joe, let's talk about some of the more noteworthy deals. One that strikes me is the curious case of Stan Bowles.
Yeah, this one is my favorite anecdote for this whole episode. The Puma and Adidas Pele Pact is another one that Puma just went ahead and disregarded. But Stan Bowles had a deal with a brand called Gola that he would make 200 pounds every time he played for England back in the 70s. He had that deal, and then Adidas approached him and said, hey, we'll pay you 250 pounds. And Stan Bowles, being the business genius that he was back in the 1970s, thought to himself, well, let's just take home the entire 450 pounds combined from both of those two deals by wearing one boot on both of his foot. So he had one boot that was Adidas and one boot that was Gola. And he went out and played for England that day or whenever it was after making the Adidas deal. And he's talked about later how that didn't go over particularly well. I'm not sure if the 450 pounds ever actually made it into his bank account, but the ingenuity there alone deserves 450 pounds.
That seems like such a small amount of money, doesn't it, Joe? My goodness me. Any other big stories? I mean, we touch on Pele, didn't we, and his Puma multiple deals with them.
Yeah. I'll add one other one. This isn't specifically a player. It is a player story, but it more gets to a concept. Adnan Januzaj, who we mentioned earlier, had a contract with Nike, and this was his really first big sponsorship deal. He had a contract with Nike, and then he was in between that contract that had ended and a new contract with New Balance. So I guess the paperwork was being filed or whatever the situation was. And so what he did, and what a lot of players do now when they're between deals, is to avoid giving any sort of attention to the old brand that they used to be affiliated with, they'll spray paint their cleats black. So he just had what they call blackout boots. And so he spray painted them, and the game he had to play that weekend was incredibly rainy, apparently. He was playing in these spray painted and old Nike boots, and the rain started to wash the spray paint away. And all of a sudden, you could tell that he was wearing Nike boots. And New Balance, of course, wasn't particularly happy about this. I don't know that it had a massive effect on his future career and work with New Balance. But it's an interesting concept to think about players not wanting to give away that marketable part of their playing attire, right? They want to be careful with what they're doing and want to use those tools in as smart of ways as they can. So I guess maybe the truth here is find some sort of spray paint that is rain resistant. I don't know what the takeaway is here, but Adnan Januzaj didn't quite
tar.
Get it right. Tar. Done.
Yeah. Joe, see, what I think, this is the way it happens, is that, like, those blackout boots, like, didn't work, obviously, the spray paint. So what I could totally see is a company developing a, like, transition shoe for when you are out of contract but haven't yet signed one. We don't want you wearing that new one. We don't want you wearing Nike anymore. You're going to be with Puma now, so you're going to wear the Puma transitions. And they have no Puma labeling on them. They're just all black. So you're not sponsoring anybody until you eventually agree to that deal. But then those boots will catch on, and then everybody will just sell the all black blackout boots with no label, but they're like, the inside is probably like heavily labeled with Puma. That seems to be the way it goes, is individual ideas sort of catch on and become innovative and then become widespread from there. And that is, I guess, what happened with the Predator. You go from one guy making these shoes and having a patent to then selling the patent for probably less money than he deserved. And then David Beckham wears them a year or two later and scores from midfield. And suddenly everybody thinks, I want to be able to hit the ball like David Beckham. I will buy those shoes.
Don't we all want to hit it like Beckham? Hit it like Beckham, the famous movie. Graham, one final point from me. And I did ask you whether it had sporting importance, these boot sponsorships. And it's just occurred to me, maybe it does. Because I think I've seen like transfer rumors, for example, where it said, oh, player X, he's an Adidas athlete. Adidas, I did it again. He's an Adidas athlete. He's going to go to Bayern Munich, who are owned partly by Adidas, or he's going to go to Real Madrid because they have Adidas sponsorship. Is that anything that actually has substance to it, do we think, that a player can be influenced to sign for a certain team because their apparel is made by the same people who make their cleats?
I think there can be influence in terms of, you always read those transfer rumors that a certain brand is going to stump up some of the cash to get a player to a club. And I'm not entirely sure that that has ever happened before. That was always the thing with Ronaldo going back to Manchester United, when Manchester United were also Nike and they were going to put up some of the transfer fee to get him back to United, because obviously Real Madrid were Adidas. I do think it can influence, using another Manchester United example. I think there was some influence in Paul Pogba going back to Manchester United, because I remember when they announced that deal, they announced it with an Adidas commercial with Stormzy. That was how they announced his, yep. Because of course they did. It was actually a really cool video. It was one of my favourite transfer announcements, that was kind of tied in with his boot deal. On you go, Taylor.
No, it doesn't matter. It was not going to be useful. Don't worry about it.
So I don't know whether it practically has an influence, but obviously it can grease the wheels of a transfer if a player is wearing the same brand of boots that a team is wearing the same apparel of.
I think for me, it works the opposite, that if I'm Adidas, I want my Adidas athlete to go play for a team that's sponsored by Nike, because then it always looked to me like that player could obviously get free Nike boots if he wants to, but he is choosing to sport another boot because they're just that much more superior. And obviously it's actually because he's being paid millions and millions of dollars to wear those, but it looks not insulting, but a little bit like, ooh, okay, maybe I don't want Nike, because that whole team is wearing Nike, but that guy's not, and I like that guy. So to me, it always made sense to go the opposite way and not have it be one uniform thing.
It feels a bit, Taylor, when you got, say, Nike cleats on an Adidas shirt. It feels like, you know, those commercials where, like, Coca-Cola has got Pepsi branding in it, and they're comparing the two products. And, like, there's laws against that in most countries, but you could do it in the States. It kind of feels like that weird crossover.
It's wild how you can do that in the States, just
amazing.
Compare one rival against another. I kind of like it. I kind of like that beef in my commercials. There's a strange, this is often a little bit of a tangent, but it is linked slightly. So, Joe, you were mentioning like blackout boots there, and sometimes players will actually wear a blackout boot of their new brand to kind of basically wear in their, you know, we wear in shoes, basically, so that the new boots, that the new brand of boots they're going to wear, they're going to be comfortable. And so Andy Murray was doing this with his new brand. He went to Under Armour and he didn't like the Under Armour shoes. And so as part of his new contract, he wore for a whole season, he wore his old Adidas trainers, which I'm not entirely sure Under Armour were getting their bang for their buck with Andy Murray basically saying, no, I don't like Under Armour trainers. I don't like them so much that I'm being paid to wear them and I'm still not going to wear them.
And you brought it back to tennis. Thank you very much, Graham Rutherford.
I always do.
indeed. I think that just wraps up boot sponsorship. I'm losing the ability to talk, so we should probably stop it there. But for now, Taylor Rockwell, thank you so much for your contributions.
Thank you, my friend. Great hosting, Ryan.
Oh, apart from when I forgot how to speak a minute ago, but thank you.
Oh, yeah, besides that.
Besides that. Joe Lowry, thank you so much.
You got it, Ryan.
Graham Rutherford, pleasure as always.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Listener, thank you for sticking with us for this one. We'll be back on the feed next week with another fascinating topic. But for now, catch you later.